Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money. My name is Alex, and we at BFRR, we love predictions. This is already our second prediction episode. But there are two important differences today compared to the episode where we discussed our own predictions. Number one, we have a different dream team today. On the one hand, we have Stefan Grassmann, my dear co-host from Tüke. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you, Alex. Hi.
And on the other hand, we have Maximilian Vargas from Blog Stories. Hi, Max.
Hi, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, Max, we have invited you today because you and your team have issued a report with 25 interesting predictions from 25 digital asset experts. So today we will not discuss our own predictions, but we will rather comment on those expert predictions. We probably won't go through all 25 of those, but I believe all of us have a couple of favorites that we are going to discuss today. Maybe before we dive in, Max, can you give us a bit of background about the story behind the report, so to say? How came the report to be?
Of course, yeah. We were also discussing whether we make it like 26 predictions for the year we're now in, but we also love symmetry. So in the end, we settled on 25 predictions across five different sectors. And how did this come into being? I think there's like two answers very quickly. The first one is like we usually did like year in review reports, but like this year we were like, I mean, it's always interesting to reflect on what the year brought, but I think it's always also more interesting to speculate on what's going to happen next year. So we said, okay, let's go for the more interesting part. And the second one is that we are about to kick off a big event series that's called Horizon, where we focus on what are going to be the next big trends, at least to our read of the industry, where this whole thing is heading. And we want to like theme everything about this like trend, I guess, part for this event series. So we thought it would be a nice idea to kick off this whole series by publishing a report that is very forward-looking and that provides, I guess, a good foundation for the upcoming conversations.
So I really look forward to your event series. I will definitely join, at least in Zurich. So you have, as you already mentioned, there are a couple of sections, a couple of categories you used as a structure for the report. Let me quickly go through them. Number one is tokenization. Number two is digital money. Number three is regulation. Number four is markets and investments. And number five is infrastructure. Why don't we just start by randomly picking a first prediction and dive into it? Stefan, I know that you have a couple of favorites. Do you maybe want to give it a go and start with your first prediction that you want to discuss?
Yeah, maybe before I start with a concrete one, I think I found an overall pattern in the whole predictions, because everybody is predicting that their area of expertise is rising next year. So I found it quite interesting because the predictions are quite diverse and very much close to the heart of the topics the people work on. And I think that's also cool that we see an enormous breadth of things across these five categories. And I would like to start with Roberto Pagliari from Commerzbank, actually, because one, because I know him, had quite interesting discussions with him. And second, because he predicts that tokenized deposits will go through the roof in 2026. And I would object. I know that many banks, especially Commerzbank and many in Germany, but also larger ones, are heavily working on tokenized deposits these days. And I think there will be progress. But from my perspective, it's a bit of a bank-centric view of the world that you, from your internal efficiency perspective, you want this to happen. You need this to happen. But for me, what's unfolding outside, if you take more an outside-in approach, you see stablecoins and even yield-bearing stablecoins or tokenized money market funds who earn the yields if you put your stablecoins into them. And I think in the market, we see a strive for getting yield. And I don't see this happening with tokenized deposits, actually. I think this will be just, hopefully, it will also maybe get more interesting conditions for the clients. But actually, it's an efficiency gain for the bank themselves operating these tokenized deposits. So there will be momentum for that from an internal perspective, from an operation perspective. But I think the push from the market, from the client side, we'll be much stronger, actually, and that will drive people more towards stablecoins or other yield-bearing savings accounts, however that might unfold. So that's my perspective outside in from the markets. I know that might not be what banks want to hear, but that's actually my quite different approach. But having said that, I think it's important for banks to do that, to also work on that angle, to become even more close to different forms of digital money. So no critique regarding these initiatives. But I think the market momentum will be elsewhere, at least this year. Maybe this changes the upcoming years, but that's my take about Roberto's prediction.
Yeah, I think, just like 2 months ago, we published another report, which was about stablecoin strategies by a couple of European banks, where we interviewed like their heads of digital assets and went really deep into how they currently think about their institution, about how they should position themselves and what they are doing and where they see like the opportunity. And these were already like the, I guess, more forward-looking institutions that we talked to who have at least like thought about it. Sometimes they already like launched also a stablecoin. And I think the big theme or big takeaway for me back then was, and this is also something that is like repeatedly mentioned in conversations since then, that like everybody's still figuring it out, like what to really do with stablecoins at banks, other than, I guess, client enablement. So that now the number of clients that approach them and say like, hey, we increasingly also use for our operations like stablecoins because of different, like, I guess, business drivers. We need you to be able to also serve us in this regard. Otherwise, we would, look out for like, or scale other solutions, other custody solutions for this. So I think this is very much still like also like a defensive move in order to fight like long-term deposit flight, I guess. But it's not really clear to me that banks currently I feel very confident about a clear new business opportunity that is uniquely enabled to them via stablecoins. But they feel like they have to react to this because treasurers will start to expect 24/7 money movement. And I think like tokenized deposits will benefit from this because they're like, maybe stablecoins, we're so inconfident about what to do about it. But tokenized deposits, is at least from like a technology or underlying rail perspective, can bring the same benefits, but within like the existing business model of ours. So let's really push hard as an industry to adopt tokenized deposits. And that basically means in pushing hard for interoperability between different tokenized deposit solutions. So I might think that like people like Roberto, who like super like close to this and working on this, might be like, I guess, over-indexing on the time horizon. But I really feel like this year is going to be defined by banks waking up and coming together in an industry-wide collaboration to at least bring like push the timeline forward for adoption of tokenized deposits.
And Roberto makes an interesting point, and it was also a prediction I read very carefully because I would say it's not 100% in line with my beliefs as well, so similar to you, Stefan. But he makes a couple of interesting points. For instance, he states that corporates continue to prefer deposit-like instruments with clear legal status and the balance sheet's familiarity. And I think that's a specific comment on a much broader point, as stablecoins are still a very young form of money. Well, they are regulated via MiCA, but from an accounting perspective, there are still a couple of open questions. And in particular, also, as long as stablecoins are not fully integrated into the banking infrastructure and banking ecosystem, it will be very difficult for corporates, etc., to use stablecoins. And that's a bit of a weird situation for banks at the moment, because partially, at least, their clients are asking for stablecoins. So banks would have to invest a lot of money in order to integrate stablecoins into their tech infrastructure. And they are thereby creating a product that harms them, because it will lead to a deposit flight, right, and will weaken their balance sheet. So it's not an easy situation for banks at the moment. And coming up with a solid stablecoin strategy is not an easy task, because just going all in on stablecoins might be a solution, but it definitely has downsides as well. Right?
Absolutely. Totally agree.
All right. That's a good start. I might continue, if that's okay, with a prediction that's similar, because it also relates to banks, namely the one of Fatih, so Fatmira Bekiri from Sygnum. Because she commented also on banks. It's now not in the digital money section, but it is in the, which section is it? The tokenization section, I believe.
Yes.
But she was also talking about banks, and she said that in 2026, banks will continue to advance their engagement with tokenization through targeted infrastructure build-out, focusing on closing the gaps that currently limit client access to tokenized markets at scale. So that's in line with what I've just said. You need banks to integrate tokens in general, but in particular, of course, tokenized money, in order to make that available to broader client space, including institutional clients. She makes a very interesting comment because she said it's not necessarily the case that banks are going to act as originators of those products, meaning banks will maybe not become stablecoin issuers or issuing tokenized assets, but they will more kind of become the enabler, the access gate. And a first step for banks will be to just create access to clients for those assets. And I think that was an interesting perspective. I've never thought about that.
That came up in plenty of conversation that we had in preparation of this report, I guess on the bigger theme also of money market funds that I think we will also, I guess, tackle in the course of this conversation. But basically that being established now is also the next killer, I guess, use case or asset for like treasury management, and how we can now see after the first round of like asset managers publishing their own or launching their own like money market funds, the BlackRock's and Fidelity's and so on of this world. We now also saw like JP Morgan with their asset management division also going to this game. And this is something that we discussed with plenty of these experts. If like the market is right or these people are right and the total addressable market for such an asset is like super attractive, would this lead into now basically a race also for banks to in-house this opportunity instead of like just acting as the gateway to passing on like the asset management fees for this to other institutions? And the common denominator was basically that the big banks who also have built out these like internal asset management divisions, also like a BNP Paribas, for instance, that they in fact are very much expected to in-house this. But for the majority, like the vast majority of banks, that they would likely enter into agreements with like exclusive agreements with asset managers in order to then, I guess, act as distributor of their products and share basically the underlying yield on the growing assets under management. So this was interesting, but which was also like mentioned by Fatih at this point.
It's a very interesting generic question, I think. How, I don't want to go too far, but banks keeping their role in the future with all these disruptive changes on many different levels, that will be that's actually the true challenge, because you have to innovate on so many levels, on the asset level, on the financial infrastructure level, on the financial service level. And I think it's not a given that these different areas will stay in one hand from a client perspective, as it feels to me, at least from the past. I think it's a lot of work in the future, but we can go on that thought a bit later in the topic. I will make that point again.
Yeah, but no, all good. I think it's an interesting point, in particular thinking about whether there will be competitors taking over part of the banking business. I would, just for the sake of the argument, make a point that is more towards there are good reasons for why everything is going to stay with the banks, which is, and I like this day one mentality of Amazon. Amazon, usually they always ask the question, whatever we do, right, a new product idea, how does this help our clients? So they have like this very strong client first mentality. And in the end, banks also have to ask, like, how do I solve issues for my clients? And the big issue that banks could solve is the client just, and I'm going back to the money part now, the client just wants to pay. And whether the client pays with a tokenized deposit, with a stablecoin, with a CBDC, or with a tokenized form of e-money, actually that shouldn't matter to the client. And banks are in a very exclusive position to say, I am becoming the orchestrator of all this. So my client has an account, there may be different forms of money, different infrastructures behind it, and the client just wants to pay. And I'm making sure that this payment just works instantly across the globe, across borders, at a very low cost. And I'm taking the decision whether for that specific payment, the client should use a stablecoin or tokenized deposit or something else. So this orchestration role could also be a role that banks play.
Yeah, but that would mean they need to keep the client relationship as in the past. And losing one asset or another asset or the payment rails to someone else this is dangerous, I guess. So I totally agree with the end game that, that this should be the goal in your five-year strategy at a bank. But the time in between is very, very critical. And if you lose people trading crypto there and trading stocks there and doing saving accounts yet at another place, this already on the way could disrupt your client relationship. And that's the dangerous part. And it's very, very complicated, I think, to set up a solid five-year roadmap and do the right thing in the first year to achieve that North Star. So yeah, I think interesting times for banks.
Yeah, I think stablecoins are basically, like, when you really zoom out, they're really like the instrument that driving forward, like the unbundling of financial services that used to be fully integrated into a bank. So you have like the money component for payments, you have like the savings or asset management component, and you have the banking component through being able also to custody your own like assets. And I think in technology, and this is like yeah, very much like a technology wave, it's always these like cycles of unbundling and rebundling. And currently, I think we're now in the unbundling phase. But you can, if you learn from history, there's going to be like a rebundling phase again, because people figure out, hey, if we like now integrate everything again from the ground up, we will be able to deliver a superior product. So this now opens, I guess, the gateways for these new neobanks that are now started to be built out on the back of stablecoins, building out on a new infrastructure. And I think, not to like jump too much from like prediction to prediction, but I think this is also something that came up across the report. This is very much a new category to watch for 2026, the neobanks on stablecoins.
Actually, this unbundling, rebundling argument I wanted to make towards the comment of Joachim Sastre from Börse Stuttgart Digital. He said, okay, now we solved crypto trading and the next big thing will be stablecoins. And to me, that sounded very much sequential. And I think that's exactly what you can't afford to think sequential. I don't know whether this was his intention, but it reads like that. And I think I hear that too. So let's get first custody and crypto trading right, and then see what's next. But I very much advocate for seeing the full spectrum of different assets developing on these new rails, the infrastructure being completely new. Then you are stuck in technology questions, but actually the disruptive change is the process change, not the technology change. It's just enabled by the technology. Then you have risk and compliance jumping around. So I can imagine you have to manage so many different stakeholders and work streams at the same time if you want to prepare for all that stuff. And somehow, if you want to rebundle in the end, so you get unbundled by these things happening, like you just addressed, Max. But yeah, you need to catch up. You join the party at certain assets, at certain services, but you need to be quite fast and then rebundle that to stay as relevant as you were in the past. And I think that's the true unbundling, rebundling challenge I see currently. And yeah, I don't know. What do you think about that take?
Connecting or commenting on that unbundling, rebundling, I just wanted to make one comment that I believe is important. We need to distinguish between retail and institutional, or corporate in that case, because I believe the unbundling is way easier in the retail space and it's happening already. And Stefan, you also mentioned before, it's important for banks to have the client relationship. I think they have to a big part lost it when we talk about retail. Corporate institutional is something completely different. And I think unbundling is way, way more difficult in the institutional and corporate space because they have their banking relationships, they have their processes, they are well integrated. And the reason why I'm mentioning that here again is because Joachim also made that comment. He said crypto infrastructure must connect directly into existing core banking, compliance, reporting and risk systems. And that's very much an institutional / corporate argument. And I very much agree with that. And that's, I believe, a big hindrance to an unbundling in the institutional space. And that's why I'm a strong believer that banks have a big opportunity here when it comes to the institutional players to actually become that orchestrator, that single access point actually to the world of digital assets.
Totally agree with that distinction. That's absolutely right. I think since we are driven so much by retail in this blockchain world, yeah, it brought us here. It came first, and then institutions catch up to a certain degree. And I think that's always where also I need to be a bit careful, because that's where you see the innovation, and that doesn't necessarily translate to institutional business one to one. First, it's much much slower. It's much stickier, as you put it, Alex. Totally agree to that. But still, I think the institutional players, they also have a private life. That's also always my argument. So if you see things on your private life getting much, much easier and cheaper, this somehow translates in your professional life, and you don't accept things that you accepted in the past. That's the danger I see, without knowing how that plays out. Yeah, so I don't claim to know that future, and I very much agree to your take.
And how much, since you mentioned it, Alex, I'm curious about your opinions, because this is basically also another theme that I think is quite dominant across many of these predictions, that 2026 also somehow marks now the beginning of a new phase. So there was like the infrastructure build-out phase, and the like digital assets are part of like siloed innovation team phase within these institutions. And now it's like moving into core infrastructure, and it's just like another technology within like the set of technologies that everything is built up upon on. And I'm curious whether you agree with this overall like direction of that this part of experimental phase is over, we're entering production phase, and that by definition means that downstream of that is now the integration into existing functions, both from like a services perspective as well as from an infrastructure perspective, but also as well from a, like an org chart perspective. Is this something that you also see on the ground, the both of you, and or is this maybe only partially true for, I guess, the most forward-looking or the most innovative institutions?
So I definitely see that. First, I very much agree with that statement that that's a general theme. That's also something I realized almost, let's say, every second prediction is talking about infrastructure build-out, integrating digital asset experiences into existing client experiences, integrating into banking infrastructure, interoperability. So that pops up over and over again in those comments. I mean, maybe a disclaimer. I mean, most of the people you interviewed here have kind of an institutional background. I have more of an institutional background. So we are not the, let's say, retail startup guys. They would maybe comment differently on that. But I do very much agree with that feeling or that sentiment that we are now moving more and more into integrating digital asset services into existing, in particular, banking or existing financial market infrastructure. So exchanges, banking, and so on and so forth. But it's very difficult to say that 2026 is the year where this is happening, because we have started, many banks have started 1, 2, 3, 4 years ago with those projects, and many of them will need another 2, 3, 4 years until this has really happened. And I mean, my view on, in particular, the global transaction banks is it's not that simple to actually integrate payments with a stablecoin or with tokenized deposits into existing banking tech stacks. These are potentially multi-year tech projects, which are, I'm convinced, already running in many banks, but it's very difficult to say in 2026 everyone will just pop up and have those solutions. I think that's a process that's only getting stronger and intensifying, but that is ongoing for some time already.
I would be more pessimistic here. Sorry, I'm usually the optimist, but I think talking on stages or in interviews is still far ahead of the reality in most banks, as far as I can tell it. I think there is still some headwinds at certain levels. So us being in an integrator role and consulting role, actually my biggest fear is that Bitcoin goes down again and that all the tailwinds we had last year are gone again, and this will make my business extremely more difficult.
Is this now an exaggeration, or do we really feel this way, that it's still somehow Bitcoin price dependent?
I think it's my gut feeling. I've been through that twice. So if the markets go down, you always have a problem. Still now, I would guess. But the other thing I think is you talk to the very, very spare head of the industry, Max. And that gives a very one-sided impression about what's happening actually in the market. And of course, the JP Morgan has several hundred people on that for some years. They are well ahead in understanding the technology, also organizationally broader, not just maybe 100 people who are fond of that, convincing some board members. I think that's not fully true for most financial players. And yeah, there are the BlackRocks of this world who obviously also in the background prepared far earlier than what they announced in the press. So you can see that, okay, actually they work for 2 or 3 years on that. So that's also true. So I think you have a wide spectrum of some people with hundreds of people working on that and making it a reality. But that's maybe the 5% or 2% leading companies or institutions. And then you have many, many in the middle who now understand, okay, we won't escape from that trend. And I would argue there are even some laggards who still try to ignore it and want to stick to the past. So I would paint a very diverse picture here where different institutions are actually saying. I think the struggle for big budgets is still ahead. Yeah, so I think that's not done, that everybody's completely sold, that we have to deeply invest. When I talk to people, there's still a competition between blockchain infrastructure stuff and AI, for example, where AI usually wins because it's more on the surface and gets more money. And I think that's, for me, the limitation, that the budgets are not as huge as you might expect for such a disruptive change. That's actually, I would like to see that very differently, but my reality tells me it's that way. Sorry.
I know. I think that's a very, very fair comment. And nevertheless, even though I agree in particular to your last sentence, we usually underestimate from the outside how long it takes and how expensive it is and how much effort it takes for banks to get that done and how much commitment it also requires. But on the positive side, what has changed, in my opinion, compared to, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, if you talk to a bank, you also were able to find people who were all in crypto digital assets and you could have great conversations, but these were usually the head of innovations. And today, actually, you can probably go to all of the big banks and talk to the global head of cash management or payment, and they will very much know what you're talking about, and they will have understood that the topic is important. Like 4 or 5 years ago, there were probably only question marks in their eyes, and that's the sentiment, in my opinion, that has changed.
Absolutely. I agree 100% to that one, but that doesn't mean it will happen this year.
For sure, yeah, I agree. So then the question is it possible for competitors to really be really kind of grab clients or steal clients from banks because they are just faster, quicker, better in building those solutions, be it payments, be it tokenization? So let's say a neo bank 2.0, which is, I think, again, distinguishing retail and institutional. I think for retail, I totally believe that it's possible that we have something like a neo broker 2.0, which is fully token based, and let's say something like Trade Republic or Revolut, but 100% token based. For the institutional space, again, I have difficulties understanding that we can really build a token native bank that really wins clients from these existing banks.
I think we miss some prerequisites for that to happen. And one comment on Sébastien Derivaux from Steakhouse Financial, actually, because he brought one prediction for on-chain wallets, that they are actually, I think, one of the less commented inventions of the last years that really broke through in 2025, that you actually really use these wallets as investment vehicles. And yet again, they are focused on retail, yeah, that you have these wallets. There are even players like Enzyme who make a vault out of a wallet, stuff like that. Really cool.
Okay, Stefan, can you maybe quickly explain what a vault is? I'm not sure if everyone of our listeners knows what that is.
It can be very different things, but imagine it's just kind of like a depot where you put certain assets in. I think most common would be a set of securities or maybe money market funds or stuff like that. So you can structure that vault, actually. And what's happening in DeFi is that you see, even for these walls, an unbundling, that one player provides the tech of the vault itself, but then you have other players who actually decide the strategy, the investment strategy, what's happening with that vault. So sometimes a plethora of 4 or 5 different players. Steakhouse is one of these guys who defines strategies for certain walls, and then users can invest in that. And I think that's, again, invented very much on the retail side, hunting for the highest yield and the most security. So that's always the trade-off between your risk appetite and the security appetite that you, on the other side, have for your investment strategy. And this needs to mature, no question. But these things, they can auto-balance. Yeah, you can say 5 different assets, 20% each, and the whole logic is implemented in smart contracts, for example. You have fully automated NAV features, stuff like that. And you can build many different products out of that. And I think this is for me, that's true power of smart contracts and DeFi actually unleashed. And I think the institutional side hasn't fully understood the power of this. It might take one or two more years, but this is another puzzle piece, like stablecoins, like regulated stablecoins. We missed the money part, and now we have these walls. It's another puzzle piece. I don't know whether that's already enough, but I think the more puzzle pieces you have, the more fantasy you get out of that. And there might be a threshold where competition also for institutional plays have enough puzzle pieces in place to really attack some of the institutional players. That's my take. I think we are not there yet, but I very much agree that these walls are a very important puzzle piece. We will hear a lot in 2026.
Yeah, I think just my take on the walls side of things and pair that with what Alex or where Alex came from the neobanks, and if they could like exercise pressure on at least like retail serving banks. I think like blockchains are very much like a network effects game. And I think we are for many of these categories and including stablecoins, I still think that we are like just before, like prior to the moment of like true exponential growth, where really the flywheel effect kicks in. And I think walls are like another, I guess, playground that we will be able to observe, where we will see a lot of these flywheels for stablecoins come in that will then have second order effects on the overall growth of tokenized assets. So in order to break that down, what I mean by that is basically, as Stefan mentioned, like these walls are just new savings types of instruments that because of the nature of them being like permissionless, like just everybody could plug into that and offer that as an like investment vehicle to their clients and then drive basically stablecoin adoption by saying, hey, here's like this like 6% yielding like savings product. You just have to like deposit like a dollar or euro or whatever, like in form of a stablecoin, and then you can generate a higher yield than you would be able to generate with your bank, basically. So this will, I guess, like from a market perspective and the dynamic, this will then drive, I guess, retailers or customers to deposit into these walls because they care about like these extra 3, 4, even sometimes it's like the whole 6% difference between what they earn on their bank. And this and then this, because what you described, Stefan, with like the role of these what are called like curators, like a Steakhouse Financial, who make these decisions on then, okay, I have here this pool of money of users from around the world depositing into the smart contract. How do I allocate this into different like lending markets, for instance, in order to provide this yield that the users expect? And what we are now seeing is that we will see more exotic instruments, more higher yielding instruments being brought on chain. And I think private credit is like an interesting category to watch here because it basically solves this chicken egg problem that we used to have when it comes to tokenized assets, that you don't have like supply in the market because you don't have the demand, and you don't have the demand because you don't have the supply. So how do you drive the adoption of tokenized assets? How do you make like high quality issuers like issue their assets on chain? And I think now with like private credit, where I think it's like an overall like opaque market where sometimes like people like have like just troubles getting, I guess, the funds and capital market access. This will, if they put that on chain and if they have like curators then allocate into these private credit products, they have unlocked a new type of demand and be able to then generate or cash in money for that. And what we're seeing like with like global asset managers like an Apollo, that they see also a new type of looping strategy that is much more efficient to be exercised on chain because of the inherent like capabilities or features of blockchains that then allows them, you know, to drive up this yield through looping and like depositing, and then you get like the collateral token, you put it in again, and then this is how you basically increase your exposure in a more efficient way than you would be like traditionally. And this is then again kicking in these flywheel effects of tokenized assets being more prod on chain, because they can attract more capital, and stable coins being able to generate more yield than in traditional
money. What could possibly go wrong with that?
Yeah, this is like the next big thing, and this ties up then to another prediction by.
Before you go there, Max, sorry, let me quickly comment on that, because I believe for asset managers that's could become a huge topic. I think they are still very relaxed for the reason you've just mentioned, that there is not a sufficient amount of assets on chain already. So there is a limited number of assets that you could potentially put into those vaults. But let's assume many or most of our assets are on chain available. These vaults are, of course, exactly basically what asset managers do today with their wrappers, right? They put different products into a UCITS wrapper, mutual fund, ETF, whatever, and then sell it to their clients. So that is actually asset management business, what's happening here. So asset managers should most likely have a close eye, because the question is, if you have a vault, is it necessary also from a regulatory perspective to put another wrapper around it? So put it into a UCITS wrapper or an AIF or whatever, or can I directly make my clients invest into those vaults, which would then be direct indexing basically? And that's something I think not many asset managers are prepared to do. So that's why, like, technically and conceptually, that could be huge for asset managers, but necessary requirement is we need more interesting assets on chain.
But here again, we have this unbundling, rebundling thing. Yeah, what we discussed for banks, I think for asset managers, that's very much revolving around this vault structure, because, as I mentioned, you already now see many different, very specialized, smaller players working together in a more decentralized way, actually, for asset management. And the question will be, how does that develop? Is this, because this also brings complexity, yeah? If you go to Morpho and look, which Morpho is one of these providers that offer these vaults that work together with Stakehouse and other similar players. And currently you're in between. So you need to be kind of an expert, or then you see, okay, Stakehouse has a good track record. I trust them that they get these 6% yield that Max was talking about. But how much exposure do I have? Do you really look down below which risks are there? Or do you then again trust the white paper or the UI, which is telling this is medium risk? Just put your money in here. So I see that there will be a lot going wrong. So this could become also the next crisis for DeFi, the next little financial crisis, that some of these looping strategies go bad. I think the Binance crash in November was one thing where everybody held their breath already. What are the side effects of that depegging of things that actually didn't depeg? And then these walls can implode very, very soon. And nobody thought this was a high risk, or they saw that risk angle. So I'm a bit torn between both sides. I see a lot of upside. I think this will make asset management much more innovative, much cheaper actually running that. But I think the risk isn't fully understood that's introduced here, exactly through these looping strategies and combining wild things together. Yeah.
But I think it's an interface question, because you could definitely argue that it's much more transparent into what these like curators are allocating into than you have it in the traditional financial world. So I think it will come down to maybe like regulation, safeguards. I think definitely when it comes to like the responsibility of like the front ends, being like Robinhood and Revolut and so on, integrating into these, making opinionated decisions on like which curators to partner with. And then I guess the brand value also of the curators stepping into the game, which was also a prediction by Sebastian, that we will see traditional asset managers starting to curate their own vaults and enter the vault curation game.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I think that's the ideal role for asset managers, because they have that trust, like the big trusted ones, right? You that's exactly what you do today. You don't have full transparency about what asset managers do with your money necessarily, in particular in the actively managed funds. ETFs, of course, they are traded, you know that, but very often, and even more so when you go to hedge funds or something like that, you don't know exactly what they do with your money, but you trust them. And same situation here. And I think it would bend, that the whole space would benefit from more traditional players entering that space, because their risk appetite is, of course, completely different. And of course, it's good that you have the transparency about where people allocate your money, where those curators allocate your money, but you don't know their risk appetite and whether the protocol they put your money into kind of meets your own risk appetite, for instance, right? And with the more trusted traditional asset managers, you can be sure that they have a certain, let's say, level of risk appetite that makes sure that actually only the very safest of those protocols are being used. And yeah, as I said, I think the space would benefit from that.
Actually, I think in that case, the rebundling or staying relevant thing is actually seems to me a bit easier, because you can a bit better watch what's happening and then jump into the game and play out your old branding, because you have a good track record of the returns that you generated from your asset management activities in the past. And the clients actually don't care too much about the technology running beneath it. They actually might prefer from lower costs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I'm much more positive for traditional players in the asset management field when they open up at the right point in time. I think you can wait until you got a certain maturity level, then just use the new infrastructure, jump with your old expertise on it and do the same thing as in the past. When you compare that to a bank, I think that's a factor of 50 or so more complex than the asset manager renovation on top of blockchains. Yeah? So my perspective, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I don't know enough about the internal workings, but seems like quite a natural way into the future for me.
Just a plug from my side. If you're in London on February 4th, we will actually host a workshop together with Steakhouse Financial, a one-hour workshop where we go really into the specifics of vault management, vault curation, and the future of asset management. So definitely, if you're in town, hit me up. Shameless, I hope.
Shameless plug.
When was it again?
February 4th in London.
4th, okay. Yeah. I think I might not be able to make that, otherwise I would have joined. Max, I interrupted you earlier. You wanted to move to another prediction.
I know. I wanted to that was doubling down on the traditional asset managers will enter vault curation this year. So this was basically the prediction. But I think maybe something we could also discuss, and I think you also wanted to bring it up, Alex, is the whole tokenized equity space. That is also, I think, mentioned at least like 4 or 5 times across the report from whole different angles. So there's the angle of fintech players or like crypto exchanges wanting to do horizontal expansion and like to have more, I guess, products to sell to their clients. And then there's the angle of traditional like CSDs, for instance, to go into tokenized equities to offer better collateral management to their institutional clients. So this is something that I think like 2 or 3 years ago, many tokenization so-called experts would have said, tokenized equities, this is maybe like the last category, basically. Yeah. Because back then, the, I guess, consensus view was almost the more illiquid a traditional asset is, the more likely it's going to be tokenized. And now I think this was also something that was like happening last year, that this narrative basically flipped 180%. That now it's about the already most liquid assets, they are the first to be tokenized. And this is what we currently see in the market.
Absolutely. And that's also what Thomas Cowan, for instance, a good friend of mine, the head of tokenization of Galaxy, is mentioning in his prediction. It's tokenized, liquid products are going to be tokenized before illiquid products. And I very much agree to that timeline you've just drawn. We all were very much focused on illiquid products. The industry was focused on illiquid products being tokenized first. I mean, we also tried that internally, and it's just 100 times more complex to tokenize an illiquid product versus a liquid one. Which is why I'm in agreement with you, Max, and also with Thomas, that I believe it's going to be the liquid products that will be tokenized first. And yeah, Thomas makes a very interesting statement also about the role of exchanges. He says the exchanges want to keep user wealth on platform across crypto, cash, and equities, accelerating their evolution into full everything exchanges. And we talked about these neo-brokers 2.0, and that sounds to me a lot like a neo-broker 2.0. So for me, these exchanges, if they now really get the licenses, and Nick Wittig, I believe, is also mentioning it in his predictions, that basically many of them are working on getting those licenses that enable them to list traditional financial instruments, including tokenized equities, of course. So watch out for those big crypto exchanges today. They might kick out their crypto going forward and become digital asset brokers, new brokers, banks, whatever going forward.
By the way, Alex, I need to give credits to you. I think in one of our first talks about blockchain, you mentioned that tokenization doesn't make an illiquid asset liquid. Reminded me, just you were so right about that prediction at the time, and it was some years ago. I still vividly remember. And same holds true for the whole fractionalization argument. When I hear someone talking about fractionalization, I also get a personal crisis, because for me, it's more about pooling, actually pooling maybe similar assets into a big pool you can invest against. I think that's much more powerful with a cool smart contract and a vault than the fractionalizing thing. So I think many, many statements from 2018, 2019, when people say fractionalizing is the future, making illiquid assets liquid with blockchain, they were proven so wrong, actually, when I listen to us talking now.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Should we do one more prediction? Stefan, do you have one last one?
I would like to talk about privacy. So Zama was in there, Rand Hindi, he said in 2026, on-chain privacy will move from a niche feature to a hard institutional requirement. That's true. And we see, I'm really watching that thing, because it's a real pain. I see privacy missing for many, many years and nobody cared too much about it. But that dramatically changed in 2025. So it's very high on the Ethereum roadmap by now. Solana is pushing it. We have projects like Aztec coming around the next days. We have Artium on Solana about to launch broadly, which is a very interesting technology for privacy from my perspective, actually. But I think 2026 will be the year where this goes into the main lights of everything. I think it's still a building year, an experimenting year in that regard. So how can we integrate privacy and stay compatible with everything we already have and stay scalable and fast, etc., etc.? There are so many other quality attributes that me as an ex-software architect has in mind that are contradicting to privacy, actually. And I think finding the right balance, having a compliant way of privacy that in case your regulator wants to see a transaction, you can open it up without sacrificing everything else, that will be a way to go. But that will be, for me, a dominating thing for 27, 28 or so going forward. If we need to get that right to get the full institutional adoption. Otherwise, everybody will be on maybe hybrid solutions like a Canton network is going for. So that's also... privacy is also their claim, so might also be a way the institutions are going. Let's see what's happening. How do you guys see the privacy aspect?
I guess from a overall adoption cycle, it totally makes sense that we're now entering the phase where privacy might truly matter. But I'm also always a bit suspicious, since I've heard this claim of this year is going to be the year of so often. I think especially it was true for privacy, but I think the overall observation, and this is why also for our event series, privacy is one of these eight top trends that we defined that we want to focus on. I agree with the overall sentiment of for retail, it didn't really matter, and it still doesn't, but for institutions, it does. And I think then it's just the adoption of privacy is just downstream or a function of the overall adoption of digital assets and tokenized money and so on. So I think this will matter. For me, it's still quite unclear of which technology will be dominant here. So I'm still confused by all these different approaches of TEs, FHE, MCP and MPC and so on. So for me, it's difficult to really understand the trade-offs. I think this is still cryptographic wizardry that is going on here, where we already have now seen, I think half a year ago, the big breakthroughs from a software component or cryptographic perspective. And now the hardware improvements also kick in. So this is now what makes it also feasible on scale from a unit economic perspective. But if I'm still struggling with what technology will dominate, I pretty much also think that inside these institutions, they're also struggling. So let's see how fast this will run.
Yeah, that was also my biggest question mark when I read the prediction from Rand. I mean, he makes some indications, as you just said or summarized, Max, that technology seems to be at a point now where you, where this can be actually used and also in a scalable way. One comment I very much liked here was that he said that basically as soon as you are able to integrate privacy features into those products without, let's say, trade-offs on UX or cost, it will just become immediately the default. And then everyone has to, if you don't have privacy, then you will lack and to that, I very much agree, but I'm too far away, admittedly. But I also feel like 2026 might be a bit too early for those things to already scale or go live.
I think the problem here is that you won't get it without a trade-off. Even with CK Tech now getting more mainstream and getting more hardware, but for me, that's sounds a bit of like an illusion that you get anything regarding privacy for free. It might not be 1,000 times more expensive. But maybe 10 times. I think it's not twice as expensive. It's usually 10 or 100 times more expensive for someone, maybe not you as the end user, but someone has to pay that bill of cryptography. Once the hardware is there and it's mass produced, then for sure. But that's 3 or 4 years down the line, I guess, until you're in a maturity grade that you can say, okay, that's literally for free for anybody in the network. And then I totally agree. And I discussed with some specialists lately, and they said, okay, you only get privacy if it's the default. So if someone needs to turn a switch on for now, I'm going for a private transaction, you already lost. I think you need to bake it into the very core foundations. And that's also the next problem for these tools that come from the side or layer twos, that they also need to attract the whole traffic towards them and get so much trust that they are part of the default stack, no matter what the default stack is. So that will take 2 or 3 or 4 years, I guess, until we're there. That's my pessimistic approach. Sorry.
I agree. You're very pessimistic.
I've got a pessimistic day today. I don't know what's wrong with me.
now I have to add another prediction, because we can't end on that pessimistic note. But there was anyway one I wanted to talk with you, namely by Matt Hauken, so CIO of Bitwise. For two reasons, he makes two interesting predictions. One, he says that in 2026, the old 4-year crypto cycle is ending. So we always had that 4-year up and down. So I would be interested in your opinion on that, which is a bullish prediction, because if we were still in that cycle, it would mean a very, let's say, bad 2026. So I'm implying, I think this implies here that he has a more positive outlook for that year. And that also gets clear when you look at the second prediction, where he says that by end of 2026, he expects half of the Ivy League endowments to have allocated to crypto, which I also found. So Ivy League universities in the US, I think some of them have already invested, but I mean every other Ivy League university putting some of their endowments into crypto, that would also of course be a strong signal. So what about the cycle?
No, I guess you could make the case that 2025 was already like a bear market for the altcoin sector. So we've seen the divergence of Bitcoin and like rest of crypto, I guess. So I'm not really sure if by any means we could look back at 2025 and define it as the typical pattern that we have seen in last cycles. So there was no furious bull market in November or December that peaked and so on. So it was so weird, I think, just generally compared to other cycles. So that's where I'm already coming from, that I don't know if that...
Already dead.
It's already dead. But I think there's good reasons for each opinion. I'm not a macro expert enough, I guess, because in the end, I think it comes pretty much down to overall liquidity in the system and pretty much also to the competition crypto assets face from an allocation perspective. This might also be actually, now I'm pessimistic, to be the bear case of high-quality tokenized assets coming into crypto, because now suddenly these crypto assets who are already like competing like on a growing basis every day because of all these tokens being like launched like every day, they now also compete with like the NVIDIAs and so on for the same capital that sometimes even have higher volatility than crypto assets. So yeah, I don't know how I got there, but basically I'm...
Oh, we have to add another prediction.
No. Give me a chance here.
Okay, now, Stefan, you have to rescue that.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know whether you saw that on LinkedIn. I predicted Bitcoin to be above 200K end of year. And that, having said that, I I read the DeFi report of Michael Nadeau before, who is also quite pessimistic. So the macro view in the last 2-3 weeks is not that good. So that could play into the whole thing regarding, okay, the cycle will turn down. But I got a very different gut feeling, and I have reasons for that. For me, 2025 was kind of a year that very much, there wasn't so much focused on investing in these crypto assets, but more on trading. So we had this hyperliquid game and all these perpetual trading things. And for me, that's a very different crypto thing than in the past, that you try to pick a good token and wait to see it succeed. So this buy and hold strategy that many people had. And now with all this perp trading, this sports betting, yeah, watch any sport in television, there are thousands of these sports betting companies. I think 2025 was very much about getting rich quick by a cool trade or something like that. And I think this will cool down and people will come back. And with all the commodities, look at gold, silver, where the prices are and where Bitcoin is. I think people will wake up to that thing and say, okay, actually, Bitcoin is undervalued. Not even speaking of Ethereum or Solana. When you see how many good things on the institutional side happened to these smart contract networks last year and where their price is, I can't get that right in my head. I think that's absolutely not aligned with what happened last year. And I think sometimes in 2026, this will be seen also in the prices. That's really purely my gut feeling. I know I talk against all the stuff that I'm reading all day long, but I'm quite optimistic that we will break the cycle and this will be quite a good year, 2026. That's my thesis here.
Yeah, nice. So we can close out on investment advice. That's also cool.
Stefan as a Bitcoin bull, it's not getting better.
Rare.
So we have to end it here now. No, anyway, we are at the hour roughly. So thanks to both of you for coming in here and discussing those predictions. And congrats, Max, to you for putting together such a great report. And of course, congrats to all the experts you recruited. So I very much like the report. We will definitely link it, of course, in the show notes. It's an easy read. It's usually a page per prediction. So it's really nice. Max, if anyone of our institutional listeners, and we have quite a few of those, still wants to join one of these events in Zurich, London, Frankfurt over the next weeks and months, where can you find these events? Where can I apply?
You can go to our website, blockstories.io, and there we feature the whole, I guess, roadshow plan. There's also going to be webinars, so you don't need to be present in one of these cities. We will also do some industry calls on these big trends. Would love for anybody to join.
Awesome. Alex, I need to add that my last comment was not financial advice. Explicitly, I need to say that explicitly. Not that I get in deep, deep trouble. That's just my personal opinion.
No, that's understood. And usually now when I stop talking, we have that short disclaimer at the end of each episode that makes that clear very much. Of course, anything we said here is not investment advice. Anything that the experts mention in Max's report is not investment advice. So you do all of this at your own risk. But we hope we helped you a little bit today to get a clearer picture of what's ahead in 2026. Thanks again, Max and Stefan, for joining. Thanks, dear listeners. Thanks for providing feedback, giving feedback, joining our Telegram groups, giving us 5 stars on your podcast platform, and hope to have you back again soon in one of our next episodes. Thanks and bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.